He was quite a nice boy, but the others have got hold of him.
Yes, they have no chance here. That is my point. They come out intending to be gentlemen and are told it will not do. Look at Leslie. Look at Blakiston. Now it is your red-nosed boy, and Fielding will go next. Why, I remember when Turton came out first. It was in another part of the province. You fellows will not believe me, but I have driven with Turton in his carriage. Turton? Oh, yes, we were once quite intimate. He has shown me his stamp collection.
He would expect you to steal it now, Turton. But Red-Nosed Boy will be far worse than Turton.
I do not think so. They all become exactly the same. Not worse, not better. I give any Englishman 2 years, be he Turton or Burton. It is only the difference of a letter. And I give any Englishwoman 6 months. All are exactly alike. Do you not agree with me?
I do not, replied Mahmud Ali, entering into the bitter fun, and feeling both pain and amusement at each word that was uttered. For my own part, I find such profound differences among our rulers. Red-Nose mumbles, Turton talks distinctly, Mrs. Turton takes bribes, Mrs. Red-Nose does not, and cannot, because so far there is no Mrs. Red-Nose.
Bribes?
Did you not know that when they were lent to Central India over a canal scheme, some Raja or other gave her a sewing machine in solid gold so that the water should run through his estate?
And does it?
No, that is where Mrs. Turton is so skillful. When we poor blacks take bribes, we perform what we are bribed to perform, and the law discovers us in consequence. The English take and do nothing. I admire them.
We all admire them. Aziz, please pass me the hookah.
Oh, not yet. Hookah is so jolly now.
You are a very selfish boy.
He raised his voice suddenly and shouted for dinner. Servants shouted back that it was ready. They meant that they wished it was ready, and were so understood, for nobody moved.
And do you know Dr. Aziz?
I know all about him. I don't know him. Would you like him asked to?
Mrs. Moore says he is so nice.
Very well, Miss Quested. Will Thursday suit you?
Indeed it will. And that morning we go to this Indian lady's. All the nice things are coming Thursday.
I won't ask the city magistrate to bring you. I know he'll be busy at that time.
Yes, Ronnie is always hard-worked,
she replied, contemplating the hills. How lovely they suddenly were, but she couldn't touch them. In front, like a shutter, fell a vision of her married life. She and Ronnie would look into the club like this every evening, then drive home to dress. They would see the Leslies and the Callenders and the Turtons and the Burtons, and invite them and be invited by them, while the true India slid by unnoticed. Colour would remain, the pageant of birds in the early morning, brown bodies, white turbans, idols whose flesh was scarlet or blue, and movement would remain as long as there were crowds in the bazaar and bathers in the tanks. Perched up on the seat of a dog-cart, she would see them. But the force that lies behind colour and movement would escape her even more effectually than it did now. She would see India always as a frieze, never as a spirit, and she assumed that it was a spirit of which Mrs. Moore had had a glimpse. And sure enough, they did drive away from the club in a few minutes, and they did dress, and to dinner came Miss Derrick and the McBrides, and the menu was julienne soup full of bullety bottled peas, pseudo-cottage bread, fish full of branching bones pretending to be plaice, more bottled peas with the cutlets, trifle, sardines on toast. The menu of Anglo-India. A dish might be added or subtracted as one rose or fell in the official scale. The peas might rattle less or more. The sardines and the vermouth be imported by a different firm. But the tradition remained, the food of exiles cooked by servants who did not understand it. Adela thought of the young men and women who had come out before her, P&O-ful after P&O-ful, and had been set down to the same food and the same ideas, and been snubbed in the same good-humoured way, until they kept to the accredited themes and began to snub others.
I should never get like that, she thought, for she was young herself.
All the same, she knew that she had come up against something that was both insidious and tough, and against which she needed allies. She must gather around her at Chandrapur a few people who felt as she did, and she was glad to have met Mr. Fielding and the Indian lady with the unpronounceable name. Here, at all events, was a nucleus. She should know much better where she stood in the course of the next 2 days. Miss Derrick, she companioned a Maharani in a remote native state. She was genial and gay, and made them all laugh about her leave, which she had taken because she felt she deserved it, not because the Maharani said she might go. Now she wanted to take the Maharaja's motor car as well. It had gone to a chief's conference at Delhi, and she had a great scheme for burgling it at the junction as it came back in the train. She was also very funny about the bridge party. Indeed, she regarded the entire peninsula as a comic opera.
"If one couldn't see the laughable side of these people, one would be done for," said Miss Derrick.
Mrs. McBride, it was she who had been the nurse, ceased not to exclaim,
"Oh, Nancy, how topping! Oh, Nancy, how killing! I wish I could look at things like that."
Mr. McBride did not speak much. He seemed nice. When the guests had gone, and Adela gone to bed, there was another interview between mother and son. He wanted her advice and support, while resenting interference.
"Does Adela talk too much?" he began. "I'm so driven with work, I don't see her as much as I hoped, but I hope she finds things comfortable."
Chapter 8. Although Miss Quested had known Ronnie well in England, she felt well advised to visit him before deciding to be his wife. India had developed sides of his character that she had never admired. His self-complacency, his censoriousness, his lack of subtlety, all grew vivid beneath a tropic sky. He seemed more indifferent than of old to what was passing in the minds of his fellows, more certain that he was right about them, or that if he was wrong it didn't matter. When proved wrong, he was particularly exasperating. He always managed to suggest that she needn't have bothered to prove it. The point she made was never the relevant point. Her arguments, conclusive but barren. She was reminded that he had expert knowledge and she none, and that experience would not help her because she could not interpret it. A public school, London University, a year at a crammer's, a particular sequence of posts in a particular province, a fall from a horse and a touch of fever were presented to her as the only training by which Indians and all who reside in their country can be understood. The only training she could comprehend, that is to say, for of course above Ronnie there stretched the higher realms of knowledge inhabited by Calendars and Turtons who had been not 1 year in the country but 20 and whose instincts were superhuman. For himself he made no extravagant claims. She wished he would. It was the qualified brag of the callow official, the "I am not perfect, but," that got on her nerves. How gross he had been at Mr. Fielding's, spoiling the talk and walking off in the middle of the haunting song. As he drove them away in the tum-tum, her irritation became unbearable, and she did not realize that much of it was directed against herself. She longed for an opportunity to fly out at him, and since he felt cross too, and they were both in India, an opportunity soon occurred. They had scarcely left the college grounds before she heard him say to his mother, who was with him on the front seat,
"What was that about caves?"
And she promptly opened fire.
"Mrs. Moore, your delightful doctor has decided on a picnic instead of a party in his house. We are to meet him out there. You, myself, Mr. Fielding, Professor Godbele. Exactly the same party."
"Out where?" asked Ronnie.
"The Maribor Caves."
"Well, I'm blessed," he murmured after a pause. "Did he descend to any details?"
"He did not. If you had spoken to him, we could have arranged them."
He shook his head, laughing.
"Have I said anything funny?"
"I was only thinking how the worthy doctor's collar climbed up his neck."
"I thought you were discussing the caves."
"So I am. Aziz was exquisitely dressed from tie pin to spats, but he had forgotten his back collar stud. And there you have the Indian all over. Inattention to detail, the fundamental slackness that reveals the race. Similarly, to meet in the caves as if they were a clock at Charing Cross when they're miles from a station and each other."
"Have you been to them?"
No, but I know all about them naturally.
Oh, naturally.
Are you too pledged to this expedition, Mother?
A mother is pledged to nothing, said Mrs. Moore, rather unexpectedly. Certainly not to this polo. Will you drive up to the bungalow first and drop me there, please? I prefer to rest. Drop me too, said Adela. I don't want to watch polo either, I'm sure.
Simpler to drop the polo, said Ronnie.
Tired and disappointed, he quite lost self-control and added in a loud, lecturing voice,
I won't have you messing about with Indians any more. If you want to go to the Marabar Caves, you'll go under British auspices.
Chapter 11. Although the Indians had driven off, and Fielding could see his horse standing in a small shed in the corner of the compound, no one troubled to bring it to him. He started to get it himself, but was stopped by a call from the house. Aziz was sitting up in bed, looking dishevelled and sad.
"Here's your home," he said sardonically. "Here's the celebrated hospitality of the East. Look at the flies. Look at the chunam coming off the walls. Isn't it jolly? Now I suppose you want to be off, having seen an Oriental interior."
"Anyhow, you want to rest."
"I can rest the whole day, thanks to worthy Dr. Lal. Major Callender's spy, I suppose you know, but this time it didn't work. I am allowed to have a slight temperature."
"Callender doesn't trust anyone, English or Indian. That's his character. And I wish you weren't under him, but you are, and that's that."
"Before you go, for you are evidently in a great hurry, will you please unlock that drawer? Do you see a piece of brown paper at the top?"
"Yes."
"Open it."
"Who is this?"
"She was my wife." "You are the first Englishman she has ever come before. Now, put her photograph away."
He was astonished, as a traveller who suddenly sees, between the stones of the desert, flowers. The flowers have been there all the time, but suddenly he sees them. He tried to look at the photograph, but in itself it was just a woman in a sari facing the world. He muttered,
"Really, I don't know why you pay me this great compliment, Aziz, but I do appreciate it."
"Oh, it's nothing. She was not a highly educated woman, or even beautiful. But put it away. You would have seen her, so why should you not see her photograph?"
"You would have allowed me to see her?"
"Why not? I believe in the Purdah, but I should have told her you were my brother, and she would have seen you. Hamidullah saw her, and several others."
"Did she think they were your brothers?"
"Of course not. But the word exists and is convenient. All men are my brothers, and as soon as one behaves as such, he may see my wife."
"And when the whole world behaves as such, there will be no more Purdah?"
"It is because you can say and feel such a remark as that that I show you the photograph," said Aziz gravely. "It is beyond the power of most men. It is because you behave well while I behave badly that I show it to you. I never expected you to come back just now when I called you. I thought, he has certainly done with me. I have insulted him."
Vexed rather than appalled, she stood still, her eyes on the sparkling rock. There was a steam and animal contact at dusk, but the emotion that links them was absent. Ought she to break her engagement off? She was inclined to think not. It would cause so much trouble to others. Besides, she wasn't convinced that love is necessary to a successful union. If love is everything, few marriages would survive the honeymoon.
"No, I'm all right, thanks,"
she said, and her emotions, well under control, resumed the climb, though she felt a bit dashed. Aziz held her hand, the guide adhered to the surface like a lizard, and scampered about as if governed by a personal centre of gravity.
"Are you married, Dr. Aziz?"
she asked, stopping again and frowning.
"Yes, indeed. Do come and see my wife."
For he felt it more artistic to have his wife alive for a moment.
"Thank you,"
she said absently.
"She is not in Chandrapur just now."
"And have you children?"
"Yes, indeed, three,"
he replied in firmer tones.
Are they a great pleasure to you?
Why, naturally, I adore them, he laughed.
I suppose so.
What a handsome little Oriental he was. And no doubt his wife and children were beautiful too, for people usually get what they already possess. She did not admire him with any personal warmth, for there was nothing of the vagrant in her blood. But she guessed he might attract women of his own race and rank, and she regretted that neither she nor Ronnie had physical charm. It does make a difference in a relationship. Beauty, thick hair, a fine skin. Probably this man had several wives. Mohammedans always insist on their full four, according to Mrs. Turton. And, having no one else to speak to on that eternal rock, she gave rein to the subject of marriage and said in her honest, decent, inquisitive way,
"Have you one wife or more than one?"
The question shocked the young man very much. It challenged a new conviction of his community, and new convictions are more sensitive than old. If she had said, "Do you worship one god or several?" he would not have objected. But to ask an educated Indian Muslim how many wives he has, appalling, hideous. He was in trouble how to conceal his confusion.
One in my own particular case," he sputtered,
and let go of her hand. Quite a number of caves were at the top of the track, and thinking, "Damn the English, even at their best," he plunged into one of them to recover his balance. She followed at her leisure, quite unconscious that she had said the wrong thing. And not seeing him, she also went into a cave, thinking with half her mind, "Sightseeing bores me," and wondering with the other half about marriage. The collector, who knew more, kept silent, for the official in him still hoped that Fielding would toe the line. The conversation turned to women and children again, and under its cover, Major Callender got hold of the subaltern and set him on to bait the schoolmaster. Pretending to be more drunk than he really was, he began to make semi-offensive remarks.
"Heard about Miss Quested's servant," reinforced the Major.
"No, what about him?"
"Heslop warned Miss Quested's servant last night never to lose sight of her. Prisoner got hold of this and managed to leave him behind. Bribed him. Heslop has just found out the whole story with names and sums. A well-known pimp to those people gave the money, Mohammed Latif by name. So much for the servant. What about the Englishman, our friend here? How did they get rid of him? Money again."
Fielding rose to his feet, supported by murmurs and exclamations, for no one yet suspected his integrity.
"Oh, I'm being misunderstood. Apologies," said the Major offensively. "I didn't mean they bribed Mr. Fielding."
"Then what do you mean?"
"They paid the other Indian to make you late, Godbole. He was saying his prayers. I know those prayers."
"That's ridiculous." He sat down again, trembling with rage. Person after person was being dragged into the mud. Having shot this bolt, the Major prepared the next.
"Heslop also found out something from his mother. Aziz paid a herd of natives to suffocate her in a cave. That was the end of her, or would have been, only she got out. Nicely planned, wasn't it? Neat. Then he could go on with the girl. He and she and a guide provided by the same Mohammed Latif. Guide now can't be found. Pretty."
His voice broke into a roar.
"It's not the time for sitting down. It's the time for action. Call in the troops and clear the bazaars."
The Major's outbursts were always discounted, but he made everyone uneasy on this occasion. The crime was even worse than they had supposed, the unspeakable limit of cynicism untouched since 1857. Fielding forgot his anger on poor old Godbole's behalf and became thoughtful. The evil was propagating in every direction. It seemed to have an existence of its own, apart from anything that was done or said by individuals, and he understood better why both Aziz and Hamidullah had been inclined to lie down and die. His adversary saw that he was in trouble, and now ventured to say,
"I suppose nothing that's said inside the club will go outside the club,"
winking the while at Leslie.
"Why should it?" responded Leslie.
Oh, nothing. I only heard a rumour that a certain member here present has been seeing the prisoner this afternoon. You can't run with the hare and hunt with the hounds, at least not in this country.
Does anyone here present want to? The magistrate was also happier. He had won the battle of the platform and gained confidence. Intelligent and impartial, he continued to listen to the evidence and tried to forget that later on he would have to pronounce a verdict in accordance with it. The superintendent trundled steadily forward. He had expected these outbursts of insolence. They are the natural gestures of an inferior race. And he betrayed no hatred of Aziz, merely an abysmal contempt. The speech dealt at length with the prisoner's dupes, as they were called, Fielding, the servant Antony, the Nawab Bahadur. This aspect of the case had always seemed dubious to Miss Quested, and she had asked the police not to develop it. But they were playing for a heavy sentence and wanted to prove that the assault was premeditated. And in order to illustrate the strategy, they produced a plan of the Marabar Hills showing the route that the party had taken and the tank of the dagger where they had camped. The magistrate displayed interest in archaeology. An elevation of a specimen cave was produced. It was lettered Buddhist Cave.
Not Buddhist, I think, Jain. In which cave is the offence alleged, the Buddhist or the Jain? Asked Mahmud Ali with the air of unmasking a conspiracy. All the Marabar caves are Jain. Yes, sir. Then in which Jain cave? You will have an opportunity of putting such questions later.
Mr. McBride smiled faintly at their fatuity. Indians invariably collapse over some such point as this. He knew that the defence had some wild hope of establishing an alibi, that they had tried, unsuccessfully, to identify the guide, and that Fielding and Hamidullah had gone out to the Kawadol and paced and measured all one moonlit night.
Mr. Leslie says they're Buddhist, and he ought to know if anyone does. But may I call attention to the shape?
And he described what had occurred there. Then he spoke of Miss Derrick's arrival, of the scramble down the gully, of the return of the two ladies to Chandrapur, and of the document Miss Quest had signed on her arrival, in which mention was made of the field glasses. And then came the culminating evidence, the discovery of the field glasses on the prisoner.
I have nothing to add at present, he concluded, removing his spectacles. I will now call my witnesses. The facts will speak for themselves. The prisoner is one of those individuals who have led a double life. I dare say his degeneracy gained upon him gradually. He has been very cunning at concealing, as is usual with the type, and pretending to be a respectable member of society, getting a government position even. He is now entirely vicious and beyond redemption, I am afraid. He behaved most cruelly, most brutally to another of his guests, another English lady. In order to get rid of her and leave him free for his crime, he crushed her into a cave among his servants. However, that is by the way.
But his last words brought on another storm, and suddenly a new name, Mrs. Moore, burst on the court like a whirlwind. Mahmud Ali had been enraged. His nerves snapped. He shrieked like a maniac and asked whether his client was charged with murder as well as rape, and who was this second English lady?
I don't propose to call her.
You don't because you can't. You have smuggled her out of the country. She is Mrs. Moore. She would have proved his innocence. She was on our side. She was poor Indian's friend. You could have called her yourself, cried the magistrate. Neither side called her. Neither must quote her as evidence. She was kept from us until too late. I learned too late. This is English justice. Here is your British Raj. Give us back Mrs. Moore for 5 minutes only, and she will save my friend. She will save the name of his sons. Don't rule her out, Mr. Das. Take back those words, as you yourself are a father. Tell me where they have put her. Oh, Mrs. Moore!
Ronnie reminded himself that his mother had left India at her own wish, but his conscience was not clear. He had behaved badly to her, and he had either to repent, which involved a mental overturn, or to persist in unkindness towards her. He chose the latter course. How tiresome she had been with her patronage of Aziz! what a bad influence upon Adela. And now she still gave trouble with ridiculous tombs, mixing herself up with natives. She could not help it, of course, but she had attempted similar exasperating expeditions in her lifetime, and he reckoned it against her. The young man had much to worry him. The heat, the local tension, the approaching visit of the Lieutenant Governor, the problems of Adela. And threading them all together into a grotesque garland were these Indianizations of Mrs. Moore. What does happen to one's mother when she dies? Presumably she goes to heaven. Anyhow, she clears out. Ronnie's religion was of the sterilized public school brand, which never goes bad, even in the tropics. Wherever he entered, mosque, cave, or temple, he retained the spiritual outlook of the fifth form, and condemned as weakening any attempt to understand them. Pulling himself together, he dismissed the matter from his mind. In due time, he and his half-brother and sister would put up a tablet to her in the Northamptonshire church where she had worshipped, recording the dates of her birth and death and the fact that she had been buried at sea. This would be sufficient. And Adela? She would have to depart too. He hoped she would have made the suggestion herself ere now. He really could not marry her. It would mean the end of his career. Poor, lamentable Adela. She remained at Government College by Fielding's courtesy, unsuitable and humiliating, but no one would receive her at the civil station. He postponed all private talk until the award against her was decided. Aziz was suing her for damages in the sub-judge's court. Then he would ask her to release him. She had killed his love, and it had never been very robust. They would never have achieved betrothal but for the accident to the Nawab Bahadur's car. She belonged to the callow academic period of his life, which he had outgrown. Grasmere, serious talks and walks, that sort of thing. The Criminal Investigation Department kept an eye on Aziz ever since the trial. They had nothing actionable against him, but Indians who have been unfortunate must be watched, and to the end of his life he remained under observation, thanks to Miss Quested's mistake. Colonel Maggs learnt with concern that a suspect was coming to Mau, and adopting a playful manner, rallied the old Rajah for permitting a Muslim doctor to approach his sacred person. A few years ago, the Rajah would have taken the hint, for the political agent then had been a formidable figure, descending with all the thunders of empire when it was most inconvenient, turning the polity inside out, requiring motor cars and tiger hunts, trees cut down that impeded the view from the guest house, cows milked in his presence, and generally arrogating the control of internal affairs. But there had been a change of policy in high quarters. Local thunders were no longer endorsed, and the group of little states that composed the agency discovered this and began comparing notes, with fruitful result. To see how much or how little Colonel Maggs would stand became an agreeable game at Mau, which was played by all the departments of state. He had to stand the appointment of Dr. Aziz. The Rajah did not take the hint, but replied that Hindus were less exclusive than formerly, thanks to the enlightened commands of the Viceroy, and he felt it his duty to move with the times. Yes, all had gone well hitherto, but now, when the rest of the state was plunged in its festival, he had a crisis of a very different sort. A note awaited him at his house. There was no doubt that Fielding had arrived overnight, nor much doubt that Godbole knew of his arrival, for the note was addressed to him, and he had read it before sending it on to Aziz, and had written in the margin, "Is not this delightful news? But unfortunately my religious duties prevent me from taking any action." Fielding announced that he had inspected Mudkul, Miss Derrick's former preserve, that he had nearly been drowned at Deora, that he had reached Mau according to timetable, and hoped to remain there 2 days, studying the various educational innovations of his old friend. Nor had he come alone. His wife and her brother accompanied him. And then the note turned into the sort of note that always did arrive from the state guest house, wanting something. No eggs, mosquito nets torn. When could they pay their respects to His Highness? Was it correct that a torchlight procession would take place? If so, might they view it? They didn't want to give trouble, but if they might stand in a balcony, or if they might go out in a boat. Aziz tore the note up. He had had enough of showing misquested native life. Treacherous, hideous harridan. Bad people altogether. He hoped to avoid them, though this might be difficult, for they would certainly be held up for several days at Mao. Down country, the floods were even worse, and the pale, grey faces of lakes had appeared in the direction of the Asirgarh railway station. Then Hamidullah continued, but with changed manner and evident emotion.
But take my case, the case of young Hugh Bannister. Here is the son of my dear, my dead friends, the Reverend and Mrs. Bannister, whose goodness to me in England I shall never forget or describe. They were father and mother to me. I talked to them as I do now. In the vacations, their rectory became my home. They entrusted all their children to me. I often carried little Hugh about. I took him up to the funeral of Queen Victoria and held him in my arms above the crowd.
Queen Victoria was different, murmured Mahmud Ali.
I learn now that this boy is in business as a leather merchant at Cawnpore. Imagine how I long to see him and to pay his fare that this house may be his home. But it is useless. The other Anglo-Indians will have got hold of him long ago. He will probably think that I want something, and I cannot face that from the son of my old friends. Oh, what in this country has gone wrong with everything, Vakil Saab? I ask you.
Aziz joined in.
Why talk about the English? Brr! Why be either friends with the fellows or not friends? Let us shut them out and be jolly. Queen Victoria and Mrs. Bannister were the only exceptions, and they are dead.
No, no, I do not admit that. I have met others.
So have I, said Mahmud Ali, unexpectedly veering. All ladies are far from alike.
Their mood was changed, and they recalled little kindnesses and courtesies.
She said thank you so much, in the most natural way.
She offered me a lozenge when the dust irritated my throat.
Hamidullah could remember more important examples of angelic ministration, but the other, who only knew Anglo-India, had to ransack his memory for scraps, and it was not surprising that he should return to...
But of course, all this is exceptional. The exception does not prove the rule. The average woman is like Mrs. Turton, and Aziz, you know what she is.
Aziz did not know, but said he did. He too generalized from his disappointments. It is difficult for members of a subject race to do otherwise. Granted the exceptions, he agreed that all Englishwomen are haughty and venal. The gleam passed from the conversation, whose wintry surface unrolled and expanded interminably. A servant announced dinner. They ignored him. The elder men had reached their eternal politics. Aziz drifted into the garden. The trees smelt sweet, green-blossomed champak, and scraps of Persian poetry came into his head. Dinner, dinner, dinner. But when he returned to the house for it, Mahmud Ali had drifted away in his turn to speak to his sais.
Come and see my wife a little then, said Hamidullah,
and they spent 20 minutes behind the purdah. Hamidullah Begum was a distant aunt of Aziz, and the only female relative he had in Chandrapur, and she had much to say to him on this occasion about a family circumcision that had been celebrated with imperfect pomp. It was difficult to get away, because until they had had their dinner, she would not begin hers, and consequently prolonged her remarks in case they should suppose she was impatient. Having censured the circumcision, she bethought her of kindred topics, and asked Aziz when he was going to be married. Respectful but irritated, he answered,
Once is enough.
Yes, he has done his duty, said Hamidullah. Do not tease him so. He carries on his family, 2 boys and their sister.
Aunt, they live most comfortably with my wife's mother, where she was living when she died. I can see them whenever I like. They are such very, very small children.
And he sends them the whole of his salary and lives like a low grade clerk and tells no one the reason. What more do you require him to do?
But this was not Hamidullah Begum's point, and having courteously changed the conversation for a few moments, she returned and made it. She said,
Adela and I talk mostly about India. Dear, since you mention it, you're quite right. You ought to be more alone with her than you are.
Yes, perhaps,
but then people would gossip.
Well, they must gossip sometime. Let them gossip.
People are so odd out here, and it's not like home. One's always facing the footlights, as the Borough Sahib said. Take a silly little example. When Adler went out to the boundary of the club compound and Fielding followed her, I saw Mrs. Callender notice it. They notice everything, until they're perfectly sure you're their sort.
I don't think Adela'll ever be quite their sort. She's much too individual.
I know. That's so remarkable about her, he said thoughtfully.
Mrs. Moore thought him rather absurd. Accustomed to the privacy of London, she could not realize that India, seemingly so mysterious, contains none, and that consequently the conventions have greater force.
I suppose nothing's on her mind, he continued.
Ask her. Ask her yourself, my dear boy.
Probably she's heard tales of the heat, but of course I should pack her off to the hills every April. I'm not one to keep a wife grilling in the plains.
Oh, it wouldn't be the weather.
There's nothing in India but the weather, my dear mother. It's the alpha and omega of the whole affair.
Yes, as Mr. McBride was saying. But it's much more the Anglo-Indians themselves who are likely to get on Adela's nerves. She doesn't think they behave pleasantly to Indians, you see.
What did I tell you? He exclaimed, losing his gentle manner. I knew it last week. Oh, how like a woman to worry over a side issue.
She forgot about Adela in her surprise.
A side issue? A side issue? She repeated. How can it be that?
We're not out here for the purpose of behaving pleasantly.
What do you mean?
What I say. We're out here to do justice and keep the peace. Them's my sentiments. India isn't a drawing room.
Your sentiments are those of a god, she said quietly.
But it was his manner rather than his sentiments that annoyed her. Trying to recover his temper, he said,
India likes gods.
And Englishmen like posing as gods.
There's no point in all this. Here we are, and we're going to stop. And the country's got to put up with us, gods or no gods. Oh, look here, he broke out rather pathetically. What do you and Adela want me to do? Go against my class, against all the people I respect and admire out here? Lose such power as I have for doing good in this country because my behaviour isn't pleasant? You neither of you understand what work is, or you'd never talk such eyewash. I hate talking like this, but one must occasionally. It's morbidly sensitive to go on as Adela and you do. I noticed you both at the club today, after the collector had been at all that trouble to amuse you. I am out here to work, mind, to hold this wretched country by force. I'm not a missionary or a Labour member or a vague, sentimental, sympathetic literary man. I'm just a servant of the government. It's the profession you wanted me to choose myself, and that's that. We're not pleasant in India, and we don't intend to be pleasant. We've something more important to do.
He spoke sincerely. Every day he worked hard in the court, trying to decide which of two untrue accounts was the less untrue, trying to dispense justice fearlessly, to protect the weak against the less weak, the incoherent against the plausible, surrounded by lies and flattery.
I've never heard of these caves, and I don't know what or where they are, said Mrs. Moore, but I really can't have,
she tapped the cushion beside her,
so much quarrelling and tiresomeness.
The young people were ashamed. They dropped her at the bungalow and drove on together to the polo, feeling it was the least they could do. Their crackling bad humour left them, but the heaviness of their spirit remained. Thunderstorms seldom clear the air. Miss Quested was thinking over her own behaviour and didn't like it at all. Instead of weighing Ronnie and herself and coming to a reasoned conclusion about marriage, she had incidentally, in the course of a talk about mangoes, remarked to mixed company that she didn't mean to stop in India, which meant that she wouldn't marry Ronnie. But what a way to announce it! What a way for a civilised girl to behave! She owed him an explanation, but unfortunately there was nothing to explain. The thorough talk so dear to her principles and temperament had been postponed until too late, There seemed no point in being disagreeable to him and formulating her complaints against his character at this hour of the day, which was the evening. The polo took place on the Maidan, near the entrance of Chandrapur city. The sun was already declining, and each of the trees held a premonition of night. They walked away from the governing group to a distant seat, and there, feeling that it was his due and her own, she forced out of herself the undigested remark.
"We must have a thorough talk, Ronnie, I'm afraid."
"My temper's rotten, I must apologize," was his reply. "I didn't mean to order you and Mother about, but of course the way those Bengalis let you down this morning annoyed me, and I don't want that sort of thing to keep happening."
"It's nothing to do with them that I..."
"No, but Aziz would make some similar muddle over the caves. He meant nothing by the invitation. I could tell by his voice. It's just their way of being pleasant."
"It's something very different, nothing to do with caves, that I wanted to talk over with you."
She gazed at the colourless grass.
"I finally decided we're not going to be married, my dear boy."
The news hurt Ronnie very much. He had heard Aziz announce that she would not return to the country, but had paid no attention to the remark, for he never dreamt that an Indian could be a channel of communication between two English people. He controlled himself and said gently, "You never said we should marry, my dear girl. You never bound either yourself or me. Don't let this upset you." She felt ashamed. How decent he was. He might force his opinions down her throat, but did not press her to an engagement because he believed, like herself, in the sanctity of personal relationships. It was this that had drawn them together at their first meeting, which had occurred among the grand scenery of the English lakes. Her ordeal was over, but she felt it should have been more painful and longer. Adela will not marry Ronnie. It seemed slipping away like a dream. She said,
"But let us discuss things. It's all so frightfully important, we mustn't make false steps. I want next to hear your point of view about me. It might help us both."
His manner was unhappy and reserved.
"I don't much believe in this discussing. Besides, I'm so dead with all the extra work Murram's bringing, if you'll excuse me."
"I only want everything to be absolutely clear between us, and to answer any questions you care to put to me on my conduct."
"But I haven't got any questions. You've acted within your rights. You were quite right to come out and have a look at me doing my work. It was an excellent plan. And anyhow, it's no use talking further. We should only get up steam."
He felt angry and bruised. He was too proud to tempt her back, but he did not consider that she had behaved badly, because where his compatriots were concerned, he had a generous mind.
"Mr. Fielding, no one can ever realize how much kindness we Indians need. We do not even realize it ourselves, but we know when it has been given. We do not forget, though we may seem to. Kindness, more kindness, and even after that, more kindness. I assure you, it is the only hope."
His voice seemed to arise from a dream. Altering it, yet still deep below his normal surface, he said,
"We can't build up India except on what we feel. What is the use of all these reforms and conciliation committees for Murram, and shall we cut the Tazia short, or shall we carry it another route, and councils of notables and official parties where the English sneer at our skins?"
"It's beginning at the wrong end, isn't it? I know, but institutions and the government don't."
He looked again at the photograph. The lady faced the world at her husband's wish and her own, but how bewildering she found it. The echoing, contradictory world. "Put her away. She is of no importance. She is dead," said Aziz gently. "I showed her to you because I have nothing else to show. You may look round the whole of my bungalow now and empty everything. I have no other secrets. My three children live away with their grandmama, and that is all."
Fielding sat down by the bed, flattered at the trust reposed in him, yet rather sad. He felt old. He wished that he too could be carried away on waves of emotion. The next time they met, Aziz might be cautious and standoffish. He realized this, and it made him sad that he should realize it. Kindness, kindness, and more kindness. Yes, that he might supply. But was that really all the queer nation needed? Did it not also demand an occasional intoxication of the blood? What had he done to deserve this outburst of confidence, and what hostage could he give in exchange? He looked back at his own life. What a poor crop of secrets it had produced. There were things in it that he had shown to no one, but they were so uninteresting, it wasn't worthwhile lifting a purder on their account. He'd been in love, engaged to be married, lady broke it off, memories of her and thoughts about her had kept him from other women for a time. Then indulgence followed by repentance and equilibrium. Meager, really, except the equilibrium. And Aziz didn't want to have that confided to him. He would have called it everything ranged coldly on shelves.
Chapter 16. He waited in his cave a minute and lit a cigarette so that he could remark on rejoining her. "I bolted in to get out of the draft," or something of the sort. When he returned, he found the guide alone with his head on one side. He had heard a noise, he said, and then Aziz heard it too. The noise of a motor car. They were now on the outer shoulder of the Kawadol, and by scrambling 20 yards they got a glimpse of the plain. A car was coming towards the hills down the Chandrapur Road, but they could not get a good view of it because the precipitous bastion curved at the top so that the base was not easily seen, and the car disappeared as it came nearer. No doubt it would stop almost exactly beneath them at the place where the Pucker Road degenerated into a path, and the elephant had turned to sidle into the hills. He ran back to tell the strange news to his guest. The guide explained that she had gone into a cave.
"Which cave?"
He indicated the group vaguely.
"You should have kept her in sight. It was your duty," said Aziz severely. "Here are 12 caves at least. How am I to know which contains my guest? Which is the cave I was in myself?"
The same vague gesture. And Aziz, looking again, could not even be sure he had returned to the same group. Caves appeared in every direction. It seemed their original spawning place, and the orifices were always the same size. He thought, "Merciful heavens, Miss Quested is lost," then pulled himself together and began to look for her calmly.
"Shout!"
he commanded. When they had done this for a while, the guide explained that to shout is useless, because a Marabar cave can hear no sound but its own. Aziz wiped his head, and sweat began to stream inside his clothes. The place was so confusing. It was partly a terrace, partly a zigzag, and full of grooves that led this way and that like snake tracks. He tried to go into every one, but he never knew where he had started. Caves got behind caves or confabulated in pairs, and some were at the entrance of a gully.
"Come here,"
he called gently, and when the guide was in reach, he struck him in the face for a punishment. The man fled, and he was left alone. He thought, "This is the end of my career. My guest is lost." And then he discovered the simple and sufficient explanation of the mystery. Miss Quested wasn't lost. She had joined the people in the car, friends of hers, no doubt. Mr. Heslop, perhaps. He had a sudden glimpse of her far down the gully. Only a glimpse, but there she was, quite plain, framed between rocks and speaking to another lady. He was so relieved that he did not think her conduct odd. Fielding was determined not to be drawn again. He had something to say, but it should be at his own moment. The attack failed to mature, because the collector did not support it. Attention shifted from him for a time. Then the buzz of women broke out again. The door had been opened by Ronnie. The young man looked exhausted and tragic, also gentler than usual. He always showed deference to his superiors, but now it came straight from his heart. He seemed to appeal for their protection in the insult that had befallen him, and they, in instinctive homage, rose to their feet. But every human act in the East is tainted with officialism, and while honouring him, they condemned Aziz and India. Fielding realised this, and he remained seated. It was an ungracious, a caddish thing to do, perhaps an unsound thing to do, but he felt he had been passive long enough, and that he might be drawn into the wrong current if he did not make a stand.
Ronnie, who had not seen him, said in husky tones,
"Oh, please, please, all sit down. I only want to listen to what has been decided."
"Heslop, I'm telling them I'm against any show of force," said the collector apologetically. "I don't know whether you will feel as I do, but that is how I am situated. When the verdict is obtained, it will be another matter."
You are sure to know best. I have no experience, I can't tell."
"How is your mother, old boy?"
Better, thank you. I wish everyone would sit down."
"Some have never got up,"
the young soldier said.
"And the Major brings us an excellent report of Miss Quested," Turton went on.
I do, I'm satisfied."
"You thought badly of her earlier, did you not, Major? That's why I refused bail."
Callender laughed with friendly inwardness and said,
Heslop, next time bail's wanted, ring up the old doctor before giving it. His shoulders are broad, and speaking in the strictest confidence, don't take the old doctor's opinion too seriously. He's a blithering idiot. We can always leave it at that. But he'll do the little he can towards keeping in quod the—"
He broke off with affected politeness.
"Oh, but he has one of his friends here."
The subaltern called,
"Stand up, you swine!"
"Mr. Fielding, what has prevented you from standing up?" said the collector, entering the fray at last. It was the attack for which Fielding had waited, and to which he must reply.
"May I make a statement, sir?"
"Certainly."
Seasoned and self-contained, devoid of the fervours of nationality or youth, the schoolmaster did what was for him a comparatively easy thing. He stood up and said,
"I believe Dr. Aziz to be innocent."
"You have a right to hold that opinion if you choose, but pray, is that any reason why you should insult Mr. Heslop?"
"May I conclude my statement?"
"Certainly."
"I am waiting for the verdict of the courts. If he is guilty, I resign from my service and leave India. I resign from the club now."
"Hear, hear," said voices, not entirely hostile, for they liked the fellow for speaking out.
"You have not answered my question. Why did you not stand when Mr. Heslop entered?"
"With all deference, sir, I am not here to answer questions, but to make a personal statement, and I have concluded it."
"May I ask whether you have taken over charge of this district?"
"If the point is of any interest, my mother should have reached Aden," said Ronnie dryly.
He ought not to have intervened, but the onslaught had startled him.
"Imprisoned by you there because she knew the truth?"
He was almost out of his mind, and could be heard saying above the tumult,
"I ruin my career, no matter. We are all to be ruined, one by one."
"This is no way to defend your case," counseled the magistrate.
"I am not defending a case, nor are you trying one. We are both of us slaves."
"Mr. Mahmud Ali, I have already warned you, and unless you sit down, I shall exercise my authority."
"Do so. This trial is a farce. I am going."
And he handed his papers to Amrit Rao and left, calling from the door histrionically, yet with intense passion,
"Aziz, Aziz, farewell forever."
The tumult increased. The invocation of Mrs. Moore continued, and people who did not know what the syllables meant repeated them like a charm. They became Indianized into "as Mrs. Moore." They were taken up in the street outside. In vain the magistrate threatened and expelled. Until the magic exhausted itself, he was powerless.
"Unexpected," remarked Mr. Turton.
Ronnie furnished the explanation. Before she sailed, his mother had taken to talk about the Marabar in her sleep, especially in the afternoon when servants were on the veranda, and her disjointed remarks on Aziz had doubtless been sold to Mahmud Ali for a few annas. That kind of thing never ceases in the East.
"I thought they'd try something of the sort. Ingenious."
He looked into their wide-open mouths.
"They get just like that over their religion," he added calmly. "Start and can't stop. I'm sorry for your old Das. He's not getting much of a show."
"Mr. Heslop, how disgraceful, dragging in your dear mother,"
said Miss Derrick, bending forward.
"It's just a trick, and they happen to pull it off. Now one sees why they had Mahmud Ali, just to make a scene on the chance.
It is his speciality. But he disliked it more than he showed. It was revolting to hear his mother travestied into Esmis Esmore, a Hindu goddess. Esmis Esmore, Esmis Esmore, Esmis Esmore, Esmis Esmore.
Ronnie?
Yes, Elgar?
Isn't it all queer?
I'm afraid it's very upsetting for you.
Not the least. I don't mind it.
Well, that's good. She had spoken more naturally and healthily than usual. Bending into the middle of her friend, she said,
Don't worry about me. I'm much better than I was. I don't feel the least faint. I shall be all right, and thank you all. Thank you for your kindness.
She had to shout her gratitude, for the chant, as Miss Sesmore, went on. Suddenly it stopped. It was as if the prayer had been heard and the relics exhibited.
I apologize for my colleague, said Mr. Amrit Rao, rather to everyone's surprise. He is an intimate friend of our client, and his feelings have carried him away.
Mr. Mahmud Ali will have to apologize in person, the magistrate said.
Exactly, sir, he must. But we had just learned that Mrs. Moore had important evidence which she desired to give. She was hurried out of the country by her son before she could give it, and this unhinged Mr. Mahmud Ali, coming as it does upon an attempt to intimidate our only other European witness, Mr. Fielding. Mr. Mahmud Ali would have said nothing had not Mrs. Moore been claimed as a witness by the police. He sat down.
An extraneous element is being introduced into the case, said the magistrate. I must repeat that as a witness, Mrs. Moore does not exist. Neither you, Mr. Amrit Rao, nor Mr. McBride, you, have any right to surmise what that lady would have said. She is not here, and consequently she can say nothing.
Well, I withdraw my reference, said the superintendent wearily. I would have done so 15 minutes ago if I had been given the chance. She is not of the least importance to me.
I have already withdrawn it for the defence.
He added with forensic humour, Perhaps you can persuade the gentleman outside to withdraw it too. For the refrain in the street continued.
I am afraid my powers do not extend so far, said Das, smiling.
So,
Chapter 29. The visit of the Lieutenant Governor of the province formed the next stage in the decomposition of the Marabar. Sir Gilbert, though not an enlightened man, held enlightened opinions. Exempted by a long career in the Secretariat from personal contact with the peoples of India, he was able to speak of them urbanely and to deplore racial prejudice. He applauded the outcome of the trial and congratulated Fielding on having taken the broad, the sensible, the only possible charitable view from the first. Speaking confidentially, he proceeded. Fielding deprecated confidences, but Sir Gilbert insisted on imparting them. The affair had been mishandled by certain of our friends up the hill, who did not realize that the hands of the clock move forward, not back, etc., etc. One thing he could guarantee, the principal would receive a most cordial invitation to rejoin the club, and he begged, nay, commanded him to accept. He returned to his Himalayan altitudes well satisfied. The amount of money Miss Quested would have to pay, the precise nature of what had happened in the caves, these were local details and did not concern him. Fielding found himself drawn more and more into Miss Quested's affairs. The college remained closed, and he ate and slept at Hamidullah's, so there was no reason she should not stop on if she wished. In her place he would have cleared out, sooner than submit to Ronnie's half-hearted and distracted civilities, but she was waiting for the hourglass of her sojourn to run through. A house to live in, a garden to walk in during the brief moment of the cool, that was all she asked, and he was able to provide them. Disaster had shown her her limitations, and he realized now what a fine, loyal character she was. Her humility was touching. She never repined at getting the worst of both worlds. She regarded it as the due punishment of her stupidity. When he hinted to her that a personal apology to Aziz might be seemly, she said sadly,
Of course, I ought to have thought of it myself. My instincts never helped me. Why didn't I rush up to him after the trial? Yes, of course I will write him an apology, but please, will you dictate it?
Between them, they concocted a letter, sincere and full of moving.